Welcome to Coffee First, the podcast about leaders and leadership. In each episode, we invite you to listen to a unique conversation about an individual's journey to understand what leadership is and how they've built their businesses around those learnings. We ask each guest to share those experiences and provide us with some reflections to put into practice ourselves. I'm your host, Adam Saunders, Managing Partner in the UK office and Global Board Member of AMROP, the executive search partnership shaping sustainable success through inspiring leaders. Today's guest is Christine Baldwin. Christine is the newly appointed director of UK for Infinitus, the real estate arm for LKK HPG, a division of the 132-year-old Chinese conglomerate LKK. In this role, she is responsible for a number of properties within the UK, but chief among them is 20 Fenchurch Street, or the Walkie Talkie as it's more commonly known. Christine's journey through leadership is a fascinating one, and we'll spend a bit of time looking at that, but in particular, the challenges that she faces now, given the time that we all find ourselves in with the imminent return back to work, makes it even more so. Welcome to the podcast, Christine. It's wonderful to have you here with us.
Thanks very much, Adam. I'm really looking forward to talking to you a little bit more.
So people closest to you that I've spoken to, you know, who frankly are full of praise, describe you in the following way. They describe you as an inclusive and open leader, someone who is customer and service centric, someone with a strong backbone in what you believe is right. Other people I've spoken to have said that you're known for your ability to, you know, de-escalate situations and predict upcoming issues or areas of friction between people and mitigate them. This speaks volumes about leadership skills, and it seems to be something that's clearly of high value to you.
I think that's absolutely right. I have spent a lifetime really watching leaders and looking at what people do and identifying those people I'd like to be like. And trying to always continue living the leadership values that I thought were important. So I think all of the things that you've mentioned are right. And the most important thing really as a leader is to really live the behaviors you'd like to see in others. And that's what I focused on.
I think when we first started speaking about doing this, I asked you, you know, what does leadership mean to you? And you listed a few things, didn't you?
Yeah, I think the simplest one on the first is, you know, you sometimes hear this spoken of as the golden rule in life, but it's partly, it's an adjunct of doing to others as you'd like to see them do to you. But I think it's also in your own behaviour as a leader, you need to demonstrate the behaviours you'd like to see in other people. So everything that you do, and you are closely scrutinised as a leader, everything that you do must follow those same principles. And I think that's key. I once heard a very humble admission of a big leader actually getting something wrong and saying, you know, actually in that situation, I lost my temper and in that way I let everybody down. And I think all those really basic things, like always trying to be the calmest person and always trying to be the most rational person and doing the right thing every time, they're the brilliant basics in leadership and you can't deviate from them. I think one of the other things that I mentioned was really truly being somebody who can let other people do their own job. Trust people to get on with what you've charged them with doing. I think I've seen so much disruption and lack of effectiveness caused by micromanagement and more than that, actually just lack of trust generally. So I think that's a very, very key part of leadership. I think I've talked a little bit about demonstrating the values you want to see in others. It's also being really unshakable on those. So it could be tempting slightly sometimes to use your position as a leader to exert more power and influence than you would necessarily need to. And I think it's really, really key and core not to do that, to be seen as somebody that is absolutely acting on the level. And also to stick to what you know to be the absolute right and moral things to do. And then finally, I think I've seen a lot of people do sort of good imitations of leadership in sort of demonstrating all the right nuts and bolts, if you like, the bits that go together to make the car. And then trying too hard to be authentic or trying to sort of put a polish on it that isn't them. I think that's always really obvious. And we hear this word authenticity bandied about an awful lot, but I think it is true that if you don't try and over-represent yourself or represent yourself as something else or something that you'd love to be but aren't, people will trust you. And that trust thing is it's a two-way street. If you are authentic with them, then they're much more likely to trust you and help you try and achieve as a team what it is you're trying to do.
So that's fantastic. And I know we're going to come back to a lot of these points as we go through this discussion. And I think the most sensible place to start is your current role. So you've most recently joined Infinitus, the real estate arm of LKK Health Products Group, which is a division of LKK. And we'll talk a bit more about them in a minute. Perhaps you'd like to tell us a little bit about the role and the building, because it's quite a sizable building and quite a sizable role, I would say.
Both things are true, yes. Yeah. So what can I say about the walkie-talkie? It's one of the very few towers in the city. It's big, certainly. It's almost 700,000 square feet, so that's quite a gorilla of a building. It is home to some of the biggest insurance companies in the world, and it's in the insurance district. It has a very distinct flavour and character. It's also iconic in design, and I think it has a nickname, and you can hate nicknames or love them. And I have to say I love them because I think they're an expression of appreciation, whatever else they may be. So it's an iconic design. And one of the things that attracted me to the role was to work in a building with a building that has that special status. You don't get many chances to do that. There aren't that many of them. I've always loved it. I like the fact that the design is different. I like its location. I'd never actually worked in the City of London before, so I was very excited about that. And then I should say the division that I work for is the property investment division. So it is very much working with the property and thinking about its long-term value and working with its occupiers and trying to help them produce long-term value for them as well. From a personal perspective, I was also really excited to work with a Hong Kong Chinese company. I have never worked with a company from that culture before. And the bits and pieces that I've tasted of it, of the culture of Hong Kong and indeed China, I really enjoyed. I thought there was an energy and a will to do things and a ingenuity that really attracted me. And I thought what I'd love to do now is to have that change, is to have that real step change in the people that I work with. And I think those are some of the key things for me. And also that the company is keen to keep on investing, and there was a possibility to work on that for them as well.
One of the reasons that I was particularly keen to have this chat with you is because sitting behind the LKK Health Products Group business is a very, very strong core of leadership values. And it would be really interesting to talk to you about that, because obviously you had to interview to get this job. You met with Sammy Lee, the gentleman that runs that division, and he has a very unique view on leadership, doesn't he?
But he does indeed. He does indeed. He gives himself the job title CIO or Chief Invisible Officer, and he has he's been a pioneer of a particular sort of philosophy of leadership called the autopilot leadership model. He's written a book about it. He's also very interested in investing in happiness in the workplace and in the world generally, and has also written a book about that. And as part of my getting to know the company, I read those books, spoke to him, and really studied and looked into what it was that drove him. And the Autopilot Leadership book in particular, it's an absolutely fascinating blend of Eastern and Western philosophy. It's about how you become not just a leader that people love, but you become a leader that is almost invisible, because you have put in place the people, the systems, the processes, the philosophies that allow you to disappear into the background and let them get on with it. And that speaks to so many of the things that I think are very important about leadership. I was very attracted to that, and I've continued to, and the business as a whole has adopted your autopilot leadership model. And so I'm continuing to develop my understanding of that and to understand how to apply the principles to the work that I'm doing and to the team that I'm working with. So yeah, there are lots of lovely big changes and some philosophy that just seems to be quite a long way ahead, actually, of its peers in some respects.
Did you have to read the books ahead of your meetings with Sammy?
Didn't have to. And certainly he didn't ask me about the books. He didn't ask me whether I'd read them or not. We had a really nice conversation, and he was probably very surprisingly the most relaxed and happy CEO, CIO that I have ever encountered. So it was quite an extraordinary conversation with him. It was via a Zoom call because this was post-COVID or just at the very beginning of it here. But I was very happy to have read them and to have the background to some of his thinking. And in fact, on that call, I asked him what his follow-up books were going to be, what he was thinking about writing next. And he was very happy to talk about that too, and about where his thinking is going and how it's developing.
So when you interviewed with him, was it a different experience to any other interview you've ever had?
Yes, I think it was quite extraordinary, actually. So I interviewed with my immediate boss, and this was before I spoke to Sammy. And in fact, I only got to meet Sammy after I'd been appointed to the role. So it was a very good example of autopilot leadership, actually. My boss is absolutely entrusted to recruit who he needs to for the business. And then afterwards, he's very happy for me to meet the rest of the business, and that seemed to go fine. It was extraordinary. Both interviews or both sort of meetings, we didn't talk about competency or experience or any of the stuff that's on paper. We talked about, and I was asked an awful lot about who I am and how I behave and what I thought about certain philosophies and ways of doing things. We talked an awful lot about the company's philosophies and how it works and how it operates. Now, look, I think behind that, there's an assumption, clearly, that I've been doing what I do for quite a while and that I know the nuts and bolts of it. And the interview really was about trust and about, I think, very much about whether or not the business could trust me to look after its biggest baby here in the UK, and whether I could work with my colleagues and in the same philosophical vein as they're currently operating. It was very different, yes.
You've mentioned already that it's a core principle of yours, trust, and I don't think there's any bigger example, really. As you said, it's their largest asset. You're half the world away. I'm right in understanding that it's the only real estate they have outside of mainland China and Hong Kong. Is that right?
We have three historic buildings down on East Cheap that back on to 20 Fenchurch Street as well. So, and they're mixed retail and office buildings, and they're so close by that they're an obvious addition to the fold, if you like, to the walkie-talkie fold. But they're very, very small in comparison. So it is the principal asset, yes.
Okay, well, look, on the subject of trust, this is the perfect segue to talk about the current situation with regards to COVID. Because I think you had been in the job, 4 weeks before lockdown happened. So maybe you could just tell us a little bit about you coming into that role with this, I guess, looming pandemic. And of course, it's happening in China, right? So you're talking to head office, it's happening there as you speak to them with the clouds on the horizon for the UK. How were those first few 4 weeks in regard to that?
Yeah, I think I've never started a job in those circumstances before. I imagine very few people have. So I began work at the end of February. I was in work for 4 weeks, really, before we locked down. But during the course of January, I'd been speaking on and off to various different colleagues in Hong Kong, just to, about various different setup matters. And I'd been asking them, just out of curiosity more than anything, look, how's it going? Because they were already locking down. So I already had some sort of company background on it, if you like. And you'll know that in Hong Kong, the lockdown happened very quickly and very, very strictly. And they were during my first 4 weeks, I'd say very supportive and asking a lot of questions around the help and support that I needed and the team more broadly needed. So asking whether we needed face masks, what precautions we wanted to take. And at that stage, it's hard to remember now, pre-UK COVID, but you know, we didn't really think face masks were necessarily relevant. I don't think anybody believed that there would be a lockdown here quite in the same way. You know, in January and February, we were still thinking, oh, this is probably not going to really touch us too heavily, probably because we'd never experienced anything like it before. And Hong Kong colleagues, of course, have had SARS and MERS and the other coronaviruses to deal with in the past. So they have more of an acceptance and a way of dealing with them and more anticipation of the problems. So it was very good to be working with a firm that had all of that in the background and therefore weren't surprised when I started signalling what was going on. The major occupiers here are, you know, they're big sophisticated companies, and one by one through March, they started running their BCP, going home for the day, finding out what worked and what didn't. And when they discovered that they could manage, they started leaving. And I think there are three different occupier categories here that we were concerned about, very concerned about. So obviously the offices and what they did was largely up to them at that stage. And we were very concerned to keep them in touch with if there were any developments here in the building or anything else that we felt they needed to know. I mean, the funny thing was, it was a prime opportunity to get to know everybody. And I did very rapidly because they wanted to talk about what we thought, what we were doing, what was best practice, etc. Then we've also got a public access space here, the Sky Garden, sort of, I'm going to overuse iconic, but very well-known public access garden up on the 35th floor, three stories high, an incredible visitor attraction for the whole of London and for tourists coming from all over the world. And our chief concern then was that we were looking after those people well enough, and that if we thought that there was any danger in keeping open, that we would be able to close down quickly and efficiently. And we knew that technically we could do that, and we know how to clear the building very quickly and how to keep it clean and all those important things. But I think we were also very concerned to make sure that we had agreement from the City of London Corporation, which is our sort of governing authority here, and which, you know, normally would be making sure that we kept open rather than closed. So we worked with them and then also with our restaurant operators in the Sky Garden to make sure that we were moving in line. And certainly as their bookings started to diminish, the restaurants and cafes started to close. They closed down sequentially. And then on that final Friday, the 20th, no one had said, if you have a Sky Garden, close it down. It seemed to fall between several stones. But because the only way of accessing it is through lifts, it was pretty clear to me that we couldn't operate it in a way that was safe enough for any of the visitors. And then we had to close. So we spoke to the city and said, we're closing. And they said, yeah, good idea now. And we shut everything down. Yeah, we kept the main office building running because we thought it was really important that all these different firms could come backwards and forwards and get documents, get access to their servers, do all those different things to support their business. And we have kept it running throughout. But we've gone from 5,500 people a day visiting the offices to between 35 and 50. We actually had 70 in yesterday, and that was the most in such a very long time since before lockdown. So,
wow. Okay, so we'll come back to that in a minute, because that in itself is interesting, how people are returning to work. But I'd like to just go back a little bit, because this, it's like a case study in leadership. So just to let me summarize, you've started a new job with an overseas employer running one of their biggest assets, among others. 4 weeks into the job, you're dealing with the largest pandemic we will hopefully ever know. You're looking at retail space, restaurant space, and commercial space, and you've adopted a team in-house that you're also trying to kind of onboard with. Is that, that's fair?
That's fair. That's a good summary of the challenges, yes.
So tell us a little bit about the team that you are closest to, your direct team, because as much as your clients are clearly very, very important to you, you know, this team have just had a new manager come in that they clearly want to get to know, and you want to get to know them. You'll be building bonds and trust with them going forward. And this is happening around them at exactly that time. How did that play out?
again, it was a bit of a blessing in disguise, because we had to get to know one another very quickly in the 4 weeks anyway, and dramatic things were happening. And those are always, I think they're very good bonding experiences. They're ways of talking about what's fundamental and what's important. And we become much more human in those circumstances when we have anxieties and when we're concerned about doing the right thing. I think it's very easy to go through the ordinary workday without getting back to your basic humanity, if you like, without actually talking about things that worry us or things that we really, truly care about. So I think in some ways it was helpful in getting to know people quickly. And then it felt like a huge break to have to go home and to work from there. So we, without further ado, adopted online technologies and started speaking to one another every morning on the Zoom call. And I think our Zoom calls in the first instance were probably one third just, how is everybody, how are we all doing? Sharing a few bits and pieces and introducing our various family members as they ran in and out. And then probably one third business, what's the business of the day? How are we managing? How are we coping? And then probably another third at the end, just, is everyone okay? What do we all need in order to be able to carry on doing this? So we had to go through the practicalities of it. We were all, you know, we're all pretty proficient at technology. We've all grown up with it. Where is everybody sitting and are they comfortable enough? Is everybody able to get their shopping all right? Two team members who live, well, one does live on their own and the other one was living with someone they didn't really know. And then another couple of team members, me included, living with a fairly rambunctious, raucous family group, trying to work out how that would operate. So a lot of being very frank about our challenges, and then some really basic stuff like getting office chairs to the people that were sitting on deck chairs and double screens to the finance people, and, you know, making sure that people could work as comfortably at home and in a way that was going to be decent for their health as possible. Last thing you want is a whole bunch of people coming back having had not just a frightening experience, but one where they, you know, they didn't even have the basics. We might be technologically set up to work from home, but, you know, we're still people. We still need to sit and stand and do all those things in a healthy way. So look, we got to know one another very quickly over those Zoom calls, and we shared feelings. We shared our, how are you feeling? We have a company tradition of doing a happiness index, everybody closing their eyes, showing the fingers on their hands that indicate between a number of 1 and 10 how happy they are. And we had some days where we all pretty much felt 4 out of 10 rather than 7 or 8. And then just talking through what we could do to try and push the numbers up a bit, or also just accepting where it wasn't possible for people to feel comfortable and happy in those circumstances, and that they might just have to, that we might just have to work through another day and see if time improved things.
And do you think when we look back on this, do you think this will be one of those situations where it will have in some way improved your ability to bond with that team and then with you? Do you think this has actually been, as you said, a catalyst for much better bonding?
I think it has. It's like having a weird reverse escape room. I don't know if you've ever done one of those escape room activities where you get locked in somewhere and you have to escape together as a team. Well, the whole working from home for me has been like a sort of reverse escape room thing. You all had to go into it together. We're all working our way out together, and how to do that safely. And we're doing it for our own from our own perspective, and then also for the building perspective. So yeah, I think it's been tremendously bonding. And the strange thing is, although we haven't all been in the same place, the things that we've worked hardest on have been on collaboration, on problem solving, on all those things that really do knit you together. So, yeah, I think it's, for the worst possible reason, I think it's been a very, very good experience.
That's such a great analogy, the escape room. That's brilliant. And that happiness index, I remember you told me about that and you actually did that on me. I found it really interesting. I've told a number of people about that. So I think that's a great takeaway. I think we should talk about getting back to work, and something that we're all dealing with. Leaders currently are trying to understand when and how they will get back to work, if at all. You are dealing with that on such a large scale, given the building that you are responsible for. It would be very interesting to hear you talk a little bit about the challenges that brings and how you've addressed them.
Sure. I think there are a number of ways that you can come at it. And certainly from the building perspective, our absolute sort of key objective is to make it as safe as possible within the guidelines that we've been given, and to try and communicate to our occupiers in particular the sorts of behaviours that we need everyone to collaborate on in order to do that successfully. Because with the best will in the world, it is, you can't have as much, you can't have the normal behaviours that mean that 5,500 people can get into a building this size and up 35 stories if they're to stay 2 metres apart from one another. So we've done a lot of looking at the government guidelines, looking at what's possible. So if you like, recreating a way of accessing the building, starting from scratch almost, and then thinking how we could do that without holding up people's day. The main issue is getting them into lifts safely and getting people up to their floors safely so that they can just carry on with their working day. It's helped us to think about the whole journey. So when people arrive here at 20 Fen, they've got off public transport. In the first weeks, it'll be for the first time in a long, long time. And they might have a lot of anxiety around having travelled in the first place. So what we wanted to do was make sure that the new system was completely clear when they arrived and they were absolutely aware of the changes. So we've done quite a lot more than usual, talking to our customers about the reoccupation plan and saying to them, look, it's going to be best for us if you, and for all of us, if we stagger our arrival times over a longer period of time. If you probably start off with a smaller group of people and build up, if we all continue to wear our face coverings when we get off public transport and wear them through the public areas and into the lifts, if we all follow the guidance on washing our hands and keeping a safe distance, and look, nobody's going to disagree with doing those things. The difficulty comes, I think, when people are a bit flustered or they don't quite know what to do. So we've put a lot of time and talking into thinking about how we handle that. And the main thing is to have people standing by to explain things and to have very clear information flow going backwards and forwards between us and our users. So look, it's all ready. Very few have come back yet. And we don't quite know yet what the X factor is. Clearly, it'll be the government saying it's safe to start going back to work again. And we can't wait, really. We can't wait to see people again and have them repopulate the building and the area. You know, these great buildings and these great streets aren't anything with the people missing. It's going to be great to see them back in the Sky Garden in particular. Although the plants are flourishing, and they really are, they look absolutely amazing, it does feel very, very empty.
Do you have any sense at all whether the behaviours of people will have fundamentally changed because of this, whether the use of workspace, commercial space, will change, even if guidelines were removed? If we had that flexibility, do you think real estate has changed?
Yeah, I think it would be astonishing if it hadn't changed. I think the things that have happened, they're such fundamental shifts for a lot of businesses. Just pre-COVID, a lot of our occupiers were saying, well, look, you know, we can't shut down if Lloyd's Exchange doesn't shut down. You know, if the brokers are still here, we still need to be here. And then we just went through necessity, the biggest work from home experience that you can possibly imagine. It was a massive experiment almost in does it work or not. For a lot of different areas of work, it's run brilliantly. There is no need to run a building for people to work on their personal workload or their work alone stuff. They can obviously do that at home now, and it's no problem. What I imagine will happen is that people will start to use their offices differently, and they will use them for collaboration, for mentoring and training, because I think those are the pieces that are really worryingly missing during the whole lockdown period. You know, if you had young people in your office that really needed bringing on and really needed guidance, they're not getting any of that experience at the moment. And quite often they're sitting at home alone, which is, you know, it's not great for them. They should be building their networks and doing all those things that are fundamental to really getting your career off the ground. So I think there are a lot of pieces that are essential to be done with other people. And then really clear chunks now that you can do from home. And I think it's almost like a trust experiment as well. I think prior to this, we more or less knew that the technology could work. But I think there was a big thing for a lot of businesses around, well, look, do I really trust that? Is everything going to happen? Am I just going to be ringing up you know, Bobby from accounts to see whether or not they're asleep. Am I going to sit worrying about that? It just hasn't been possible to worry about that. You've had to get on and trust your team. Now, for some companies, maybe that's been a terrible experience and they've discovered they couldn't trust their team. But I've got great faith in human nature. And I believe that the majority are going to come away from that saying, wow, that was an amazing result. You know, I do know that people can get on with stuff and maybe be more productive in some areas at home than at work. So I don't think that the need and desire to work together will ever stop. And I think that if anything, what we do in our spaces, our commercial office spaces, will become much more important and much more focused, because I think it'll be seen as a sort of a pivotal part of the business that needs to happen really efficiently. We need to get more out of it almost now we know that we can't dedicate all our space to it. So I think some things will stay the same. I think the importance of being co-located with similar sorts of businesses is going to come back, and people will be hungry for that. Doing business together, people will be hungry to do that as well. You'll have seen the indicators for productivity in the last 3 months haven't been amazing. And I think that the desire to attract and retain talent and to really nurture and develop people's careers will still be there as well. And you can only really do that by having people work with you and alongside you. And all that creativity and collaboration, that's got to happen together. And then a lot of other stuff, yes, do it at home and have a much more enriched family life and private life as a result. That sounds like a great way to retain people.
I think you're right. I think the pendulum has swung very far one way, of course, and it will settle back near the middle. And if everybody has a better quality of life as a result of it, professionally and personally, then productivity, businesses will thrive and be better for it. I would love to go backwards a little bit into your earlier career history. Because when you left university, you didn't settle into real estate as a sector, did you? You started life in the Foreign Office.
Yeah, that's right. I was one of, I studied an arts degree, didn't really rightly know what I wanted to do at all. And in my final year at uni, I applied for the civil service fast stream and got into the Foreign Office. And that's what I did. So I did it for a couple of years and I had a great experience. It was a very exciting time. And I had a really inspiring boss in my first role, which I think is one of the best things that can happen to you when you hit the working world. And Foreign Office at that time, august and noble institution, still is, no matter what anybody says, I would defend it to anyone that that has words about it. Very traditional and very hierarchical. And I worked for a brilliant woman, a real intellectual. And that was a great way to hit the workplace, seeing a particularly effective woman pit her brains against thorny and difficult questions and responding to them with brilliant ideas. So, yeah, that was a great way to begin working, but very different from real estate, yeah.
So what struck me about your first job and your first role is that, of course, you're in a very hierarchical organization, and that of course your first leader, your first manager is a woman, but importantly that in actual fact she had a very particular way of managing, didn't she? It left an indelible mark on you as to how to manage and lead people.
Yeah, I think that's it was a great experience. You don't know how lucky you are at the time to have such. I think you never know how much you're learning until you reflect on it and you look back and think, actually, that was a great experience to have. So that was someone very, very clever, but whose managerial style was, I think brusque is a nice word for it. And I think I remember reflecting at the time that when you rub people up the wrong way, whatever your intentions are, you then spend an awful lot of time, or somebody spends an awful lot of time sort of brushing up the pieces and trying to get everybody to refocus on what it is they should be doing. And I remember watching it in action thinking, well, it's great in some ways, but it's not very productive. But, you know, we'd all love to just say, oh, don't be silly, do this. But that's not actually how to lead people. It's not how to get a team of people moving in the same direction and trying to get them to understand a philosophy and act on it and move along a set of strategic goals. So, yeah, it was a very good learning experience for me. And that particular leader had a brilliant second in command who basically, you know, manned the blood wagon and swept up after them. I remember thinking a bit of both of that is what you need.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it can't be underestimated just probably how challenging it was at that time to hold that sort of position in that sort of organization. And I find it fascinating that you have this exposure to that. But the real tragedy of the story, of course, is that her life ended tragically too soon, didn't it? And that threw you then into a very, very unique set of experiences in your then role.
Yes, it was a shockingly early death, and you know, something that the other person that I've mentioned helped all of us with. Actually, that was another good learning experience, that having a boss who really, really looked to the sort of pastoral side of working life, not just the professional side, and helped us through what I imagine for some people would have been their first experience of death. And it threw me in, into a very, very strange experience where the department that I worked in, for long historic reasons, formed part of an ambassadorial group. And I then had to make an official visit to a series of West African countries on behalf of the Foreign Office. Sorry, I'm laughing at it as I say it, because the more often I look back on it, the more crazy it seems. Had to do this official visit, and I was 22, 23, something like that, just, you know, flying off to the middle of the desert and carrying out a series of engagements that had been organised by somebody very, very nicely, actually, meeting a whole bunch of people. And I remember at the time thinking, I know that I'm here in an official capacity representing the Foreign Office, representing the UK. But I'm fairly certain the people I'm speaking to know a little bit more about what they're doing than I do. but nevertheless, I've been sent here to do a job. So I got on and did it. And now when I look back on it, I think that was great. So much trust was put in me to do the right thing and to just get on with it and not worry about it. And that again was a real gift, actually, to be trusted, to be told to get on with it. And it's the thing that we, you know, I think as leaders always need to remember that it's pretty rare that level of trust is not repaid, and it's probably better to risk it. If you're certain that you've picked the right person, it is better to risk it and get the opportunity of seeing it play out well. So that was an extraordinary experience, and I'm very glad I had it.
And then of course you make another brave move. You suddenly take this sort of strong right into the world of opera. So what led that decision and what ultimately drove you to opera as a potential new career?
Yeah, I think that was another opportunity that came my way, and it gave me the chance to jump into things that I felt very passionate about. So I'd studied English literature at university. I'd always been really strongly interested in classical music. And I was pretty clear that the sort of hierarchical world of the Foreign Office wasn't for me. And it was a strong right. I plunged into a completely different direction and started working in the performing arts, not as a performer, but as one of the people that are sort of behind the scenes trying to put the show on the road. Again, actually, I had brilliant bosses who wanted to, they were terrible at some of the business areas of what they did, mostly, but had great insight into performance, into personality, into putting on a show and getting everything moving together in the right direction. And gave me a lifelong passion for opera, which is it's ridiculous passion to develop. It's way too expensive, and it rules out most of your friends. But nevertheless, I'm very fond of it still. And at least one of those bosses I'm still really good friends with, and I can remember the moments at which they taught me different things about voice, different things about different aspects of performance, and gave me great advice on how to handle personalities, because if you think you get some exciting personalities in the Foreign Office, I think opera knocks all that into a cocked hat. You have to deal with people with very, very strong, intense artistic temperaments, utter perfectionists, people who are sometimes acting or performing in something that they have waited a lifetime to do, and, you know, are under a bit of pressure as a result. So very, very interesting study of people, and very valuable.
And a very good example of, you know, the old adage, do something you love and throw yourself into it. But I know that
after a while, it became obvious to you that that then wasn't going to necessarily pay all the bills. And then you put yourself back out there, didn't you, into the workplace to try and find the next challenge?
I did. And I landed in a property development firm. And I didn't know anything really about property development. Oh, I'll do my lunchtime story for you. So I was beavering away in the temp job that I was doing for them. And I thought at lunchtime, I'd better read up on what these guys do, just so that, you know, when people ring up, as they did in those days, when people ring up, I'll be able to explain it properly. So I read up on the business at lunchtime. And at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, somebody came over here and said, "You, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm temping." And they said, "Well, what do we do here? Do you know yet? Do you know what this company does?" And fortunately, because I'd read the brochure and I was interested, I was able to explain what the business did, what it was based on. And I'd also looked around the company that afternoon and thought, actually, they all look like they're having good fun. I can see that they're making money here and they look like they're having good fun. So I kind of landed into that business, and it was a US-UK company, a joint venture. And I think I then had the brilliant experience actually of working in an entrepreneurial US firm, which is a truly democratic and exciting experience. I've worked for a couple of them, and when they are in full fire mode and want to get on and do something, the opportunities offered and the sort of the lack of inhibition in saying, right, if you're somebody who can do stuff, we've got stuff to do. Probably gave me my property opportunity, really, my real estate opportunity. I'm very grateful for it because it doesn't have the drama of opera every day. It has it some days, and it has a lot of interest and variety to it.
Well, it obviously has, because clearly it did engage you, because thereafter you have a very long and successful career in the sector, and obviously you remain there to this day.
That's right. I have to say I've had the chance to work in lots of different areas of real estate, in property development, in investment, on the asset management side. So all different parts of the food chain. And there's always something new to do, always something new to discover and learn. It's interesting, actually, we mentioned the sort of what's going to happen after COVID-19. I think that shows another way in which the real estate sector is going to need to develop and change and adapt. We've already had the tech revolution changing the way that we work. So, it's been a really great sector to work in, and I haven't stopped. I'm really keen to keep going and keep learning and changing with it.
Okay, very good. Look, let's take your entire career history in the round, and then look a little bit then at what you've learned, particularly about leadership. So, I'm just gonna ask you about some of the key pillars of leadership as it's explained, as it's described, at least in theory. You don't have to dig very deep into leadership theory to look at behavior and style theory to understand that communication is a key pillar of leadership. How do you view communication?
I think I've learned so much about it. I think it's absolutely key. I think it's very easily misunderstood. It's one of the areas I constantly read about, actually. I think face-to-face communication is the most important of all. I've lived through the email revolution and seen it sort of blow up from a brilliant sort of messaging system into a sort of a means of miscommunicating if it's not used carefully. I value listening very, very highly, as much as communicating my message. And I've learned to do that more and more as I've got older, and to listen really actively. And also, I think, to really, really reflect on people's styles of communicating with me, because not everybody does it the same way. So you listen differently for different people. You listen to what they're trying to say to you in different ways, and you communicate differently to them as well. I think it has to be a constant study for anybody who wants to, well, work efficiently and effectively in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is the optimal communication method for you?
What I would say is, if I really want to talk to somebody, I would take them for a walk in the park, or I'd go for a drive with them and give them that opportunity to just open up without having to feel as though it's an interrogation, but really try and take everything away from the ordinary situation and let them just concentrate on saying what it is they need to say, and then listening and communicating properly and effectively. It's, you know, it's something that I've used very successfully in my private life, and I think it works professionally as well. So go for a nice walk. Yeah, definitely.
And communication is, of course, talking and listening. And I know you value listening very highly, don't you? What have you learned about listening that we could learn?
I think I'm really keen on listening very actively, and that would include looking at and watching the person that you're listening to very carefully. Listen to all their signals, to what they're telling you with their body language, to what they miss out, to all those critical and key things. Actually, I should probably mention, so one of my children has a hearing impairment and she's a learning disorder as well. And so to communicate with her has actually been a huge part of my communication experience and my growth in it. And she doesn't hear a lot of what people say, and she's very good at covering for it. So when I listen to what she's saying and her answers, a lot of the time I'm trying to check, actually, has she heard what it is she really thinks she's heard? And now, what is it she's trying to say back to me? Her speech isn't brilliant. We also sign, and signing is a combination of sort of quite exact movements and then a lot of gesture and a lot of really trying to use your body and your voice to get the impact over. So I think working with her has really helped me with the active listening and talking. But yeah, I think it's a constant study. And as you get to know somebody, you get to be able to read their signals much more efficiently, I think. And it's the brilliant thing about this working from home has been that it's more efficient and all the rest of it. But the real hunger it leaves us all with, I think, is that proper contact, that face-to-face contact. And I'll be very glad when we get it back.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's quite right. When you look back at your career, and you think about the journey you've been on and the learnings that you've had, what advice would you give your younger self if you had the benefit of your experience today?
I'd probably say don't worry. I'd also say, and I think for me this one's really important, which is quite often when I was younger, I'd be hesitant about putting forward an idea because I would think, well, that's really obvious. We should definitely try that. And everybody else must have thought of that and discounted it, or there must be something wrong with that idea. And I sort of missed out on, I didn't consider the fact that maybe I was the only person that was having that particular good idea. And maybe it wouldn't hurt to just throw it into the ring and see whether or not it was something we could do. So I would say, don't miss that opportunity to put your idea forward, is what I'd say to my younger self.
Yeah, good advice. And when you look forward now, when you look to the future, what does good look like for you, Christine Baldwin, as you look towards, you know, the next 10 years? What would success mean to you?
I think it's carrying on learning about this brilliant new company that I'm working with and the culture that it springs from. That's a huge thing for me. Continuing to work and to grow the team that I have here, to have this asset continue to be, and the other assets that we may take into management, the best assets that they can possibly be, and that we're the happiest and most satisfied customers, definitely. And those things obviously underpin the financial success of the company. But for me personally, also, it will be developing the situation here to the point where I can walk away very easily and become as invisible as Sammy Lee. I think that would be the, that's absolutely my aim for my role here.
Fantastic. Look, I think we could have done probably 3, 4, 5 hours talking about your career. I feel like we've skimmed the surface, literally. Okay, Christine, so what would you say to a younger version of yourself who's about to enter real estate? Would you encourage someone to do that?
Yeah, I really would. I would encourage them to try and find out as much about it as possible, because it covers a really broad range of roles. There's lots of interesting things you can do in real estate. You can do any of the technical roles, investment roles, lots of different things. And then these up and coming sort of concierge and experience type roles as well. And I would really encourage them to give it a try and to find out what it's all about. We need lots of enthusiastic young women of all shapes and sizes in the in the real estate profession.
Very good. Well, they know where to find you, Christine. Your building's not hard to miss. Okay, Christine, so just a few questions to round off, just to get to know you that little bit better. Pick one of the following, tea or coffee?
Tea, all day long.
Is that because you're from Yorkshire, Christine?
It probably is, but anybody that knows me well knows that I'm utterly obsessed with it. And yes, I'm from Yorkshire. It's a very important beverage. It's the only beverage, I think. There we go.
Okay. Book or Audible?
Book. Total bookworm.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs. It's dogs all the way for me, I'm afraid.
Instagram or Twitter?
Twitter. There are days when I have to switch it off, but it's quite often the funniest thing you can possibly read. So Twitter.
Okay. Last one. Gig, concert or theatre?
Ooh, these days I'm agnostic. All three. I can't choose very easily. I've probably done enough theatre and I probably could do with more gigs in my life. So let's go gig.
And the last question that I really love to know, particularly because you're a self-confessed bookworm, which book have you read recently that you'd recommend for anyone who's listening to read?
Oh, it's a bit nerdy. So I'm one of the many people that's been subscribing to one of the COVID-19 apps. So I've been doing the Zoe app where you report your symptoms every day. And the guy that's managing that, Professor Tim Spector, has written a book called The Real Science Behind What We Eat, The Diet Myth. And it's fascinating. That I would absolutely recommend anyone to read. It's brilliant.
I've actually got a copy of it right here. It's one of my favourite books.
That's so weird. It's very, very, very interesting. And it also endorses some of my favourite foodstuffs. It's lovely to be told that it's fine to eat cheese.
That's exactly what I did. And the minute I finished reading that book, I went and bought myself a load of French cheese and just ate it, knowing that I was doing myself the world of good, that my microbiome was sort of celebrating my consuming piles and piles of cheese. That's so good. All right, Christine, look, I think that's it. I think you've been more than generous with your time. And I would just like to say thank you very, very much for being a guest on the podcast, because I think your story, your career story, is absolutely fascinating. I think the role that you are in now is hugely interesting, and not least of all because of the business that sits behind it and the cultural values they have, but because of the time we find ourselves in today. So thank you very, very much for sharing your stories with us.
Adam, you are really welcome. It was great fun.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Coffee First. Please don't forget to hit the subscribe button, follow our Twitter account, CoffeeFirst13, and follow the Amrop UK LinkedIn page for all company updates. We look forward to inviting you back for the next episode of Coffee First.